Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with your American Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. Albany, New York. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo calls for legalization of recreational cannabis. The New York governor, in his annual State of the State address Wednesday, used the opportunity to advocate for a mix of practical progressive goals and urgent responsibilities, including waging war on hate crimes, spending $3 billion on environmental projects, and legalizing recreational marijuana. In his policy briefing book that accompanied the speech, Cuomo said that the proposal to legalize marijuana would limit the sale of cannabis products to adults over age 21, but he only briefly mentioned his legalization proposal in his address Wednesday to tepid applause. Hartford, Connecticut. People who live in states where cannabis is legal have more sex, study finds. If cannabis gets you in the mood, you're not alone. Science says so. A study whose findings were recently released by the University of Connecticut and Georgia State University found that in states where medical marijuana was legalized, the rate of sexual activity went up. The study's co-author, University of Connecticut Assistant Professor David Simon, said that he wasn't ready to commit on whether his findings was a good or a bad thing. But regardless, we believe it should be something society and policymakers consider as part of the conversation on legalization. But wait, there's more. In those same states with medical cannabis regulation, there was an uptick in the birth rates by a mean of 2% and a drop in the use of contraceptives while having sex. Seattle, Washington. Seattle-based marijuana delivery service could be using drones soon. In an effort to save money on logistical cost, a cannabis company has announced its plans to deliver product to Seattle businesses with drones. The high-flying partnership was publicized last month by GRN Holding Corporation, which is carrying out a plan by purchasing an aggressive name Bellevue, Washington company called Squad Drone. The drones could be hoisting marijuana above your head for test deliveries as quickly as February or March. We anticipate the entire industry will adopt this where applicable, said GRN Holding Corporation CEO Justin Costello in a December press statement, which estimates that the drones will dramatically cut down on the cost associated with getting cannabis to where it needs to go. Denver, Colorado. In our final story, legal marijuana shops refuse sales to underage customers, study finds. A new study published in the Journal of Studies of Alcohol and Drugs this month finds that compliance with the laws restricting marijuana sales to those 21 and older with a valid ID was high in two western states, which were the first to legalize cannabis. To determine whether age and identification restrictions policies are working as intended, the team of researchers sent would-be buyers who appeared young with no ID who were underage into 85 stores in Colorado and 90 in Washington to investigate their adherence to the state laws. That's your quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. Who's joining the conversation today? Emily Flippin from The Motley Fool will join us of what to look for to buy in 2020. Dr. Jordan Tischler, our cannabis doctor on call, is going to speak about treating PTSD with cannabis. In a rare appearance, Big Mike, Mr. Cannabis, is going to be talking to us today about the history of the industry that he helped form. Our last member to the conversation is Brett Smores, who's going to talk about growing, harvesting, and processing cannabis. So let's listen to the conversation.
We're talking to Big Mike. Big Mike is a founder of the legal cannabis industry and has done incredible amounts of research and development for products and has a growing medium. And the name of the growing product, Mike?
It's Advanced Nutrients. It's not just growing medium. It's a line of products that take cannabis from seed to senescence and optimize the development every stage of the way so the plant can reach its true genetic potential.
So what I want to ask you now is, as a person who's been involved, I think you said 35 years, where do you see this industry going? You talked about in a previous show, you talked about how some people are throwing money and making no money or losing money. But where do you see this industry going?
Wow. Okay. So you're going to see cannabinoids, and especially CBD, you're going to see it put into a lot of different products, like obviously cosmetics. You see, even South Korea right now is allowing it and putting it in cosmetics. You're going to see it in dog food. You're going to see it all over the place. And the global market for cannabis within the next 20 to 25 years will be a $1 trillion global industry. And you have to also remember, there's textile uses of hemp as well. I have a friend who makes dashboards and car door panels for Mercedes, Audi, BMW. He's been doing this for probably the last 12 years, where they take plastic and hemp and they fuse it together. It's as strong as, almost as strong as carbon fiber, just as light and a fraction of the cost. But Mercedes won't let them talk about it. So, you know, and then again, you're going to see in clothing and for all kinds of industries, you're going to see the textile industrial use of hemp. And then when you talk about the medical use and the adult use of it, which is the recreational market, it's staggering to see the numbers. I remember I was talking to the governor of the state of California, Gavin Newsom, and he goes, Mike, he goes, how big do you think it's going to get in California? And I said, it's going to be a $50 billion industry here in California alone. You got to remember also that California is the fifth largest economy in the world. And he goes, do you really think so? I said, absolutely. And I actually think it will eventually surpass that, because we've just touched the tip of the iceberg of all the potential of this of uses of this plant.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because the governor recently indicated that the forecast of tax revenue in the state of California looks like it might be $2.5 billion less than what they thought it was going to be, and some people are questioning the burdensome taxes that the state places on the product to try and solve other problems is affecting the sales. And so that on the retail space, you have people who are selling in the black market can sell not the same quality as cannabis as you can in your dispensaries, but they can sell it for 50 cents on the dollar. The user is looking at it from an economic standpoint and says, I'll just go buy the black market stuff.
You're exactly right. The black market and the taxation are two of the biggest issues that are going on. And when they tax, they don't just tax the patient at the store level. You have to remember, they're taxing the grower, they're taxing the extractor, everyone up the chain has their own individual tax, as well as the patient has a tax to pay. And you're exactly right. That high taxation is one of the reasons that is keeping this market, keeping dispensary owners from turning profits. Also, this thing where they're willing to throw good money after bad money, I call it going negative, where they sell something for less than what it's worth, is also causing a lot of lost profits. I mean, it makes it harder for a dispensary, for a grower, for everybody to make a profit, because the big boys are coming in and they're buying something for $300 and they're selling it for $200. And so that alone is just as big as the other two when it comes to, you know, gutting out the profitability of an industry. Now, that will eventually change, and here's how it's going to change. As there's a consolidation roll-up happening, you're going to see these bigger corporations go banging on government door and going, hey, you got to lower the taxes. And so a lot of what's going on today is actually raising what they call the barrier to entry. And at the end of the day, just like every other industry, there's going to be a number one and two, and they're going to be the major players. You're still going to have, you know, other smaller players. It's always like that in any industry. You've got, you know, the high level connoisseur that wants something in the wine industry. You got Harlan Estates and Screaming Eagle and these kind of brands that, you know, and then you got Two Buck Chuck at Trader Joe's here in California, which is like $2, $3, $4 a bottle. So, I mean, you're going to have the same thing in this industry as well, but there's going to be, you know, two or three really big dominant players globally, and there'll be a lot of small players around doing their thing.
You were talking about the infusions, and I've read yeah. where Coca-Cola is looking at buying growers, and Miller Brewing and Philip Morris is looking at buying growers for infusion into wine and beer and even tobacco. And is the infusion side of the business likely to be much bigger than people think about?
Yeah, the infusion side of the business is going to be now when infusing an alcohol, when you mix cannabis and alcohol, a lot of folks will get very nauseated and sick. But you're going to see cannabis beverages that, you know, someone drinks like a beer and they have an effect 10 or 15 minutes later, you're going to be able to drink a cannabis beverage and it will give you a specific feeling because you can adjust the outcome and the feeling and the type of high that you're looking for also. So it's going to be interesting to see. So this brings up another thing. It's going to be about delivery systems. Who's got the fastest delivery system? When you put on a lotion, how fast does it get through the epidermal layer and into the blood and past the blood-brain barrier? So it's going to be, you know, it's like a, what do you want to call it, gunslingers in the West who has the quickest draw. That's going to come into play as well as how quickly you can feel the effects of cannabis. But infused products are going to be huge. In fact, we call it the edible market. And the two major markets are the flower market, which are the buds that people smoke, and vape pens. And vape pens are going to be huge, and then it's edibles. So that's how it is right now. It's flower, vape pens, and edibles are the three big ways that people are consuming. And, of course, pills. Some people like to take pills. We've habituated our society on taking pills, and you can take it in a pill form as well.
As somebody who's been involved in the cultivation and development of the plant itself, what kind of new products are you contemplating growing in your test warehouses or grow gardens or whatever? What's under study at the moment?
Well, what's under study is genetics. Right now, I've mapped out the entire cannabis genus with a male and female of cannabis indica. These are what they call land races, which are indigenous and been acclimatized to an area where they were found. And I've done it with cannabis sativa, cannabis indica, and cannabis ruderalis. And then I've taken the female plants, and I've done something called an annotation, which breaks up the gene sets. And I'm in my third phase right now, which is assaying to figure out which ones turn on different, do different things. So genetics is going to come into play because the future of cannabis is going to be genetically editing plants. That's not genetically modifying them. It's just cutting out certain gene sets so the plant will make certain types of cannabinoids or terpenoids or compounds that you're looking for. And that's going to be the future. And then also biosynthesis. They're looking at my science has been doing this for 7 years, programming yeast to grow certain types of rare cannabinoids. So it'll be outdoor growing and also in the laboratory, biosynthesizing or growing it in different ways using different technologies, different cannabinoids and terpenoids.
Does it make any difference, Big Mike, as to whether it's grown outside or in a controlled environment?
Well, the reason on that it was growing indoors, and most growers today grow indoors, is because they were hiding it from the police and thieves. And so let's face it, cannabis is an agriculture product. And so a lot of the strains that are being used today were bred for indoor use. And by the way, when they're in the recreational market, these guys were growing, they actually bred CBD, which is another cannabinoid part of the plant, out. Because CBD will attenuate or push down the high or lower the high. So that was bred out. So now there's this big resurgence of finding strains that are high in CBD, low in THC. So it's an evolution that will involve genetics and science and using recombinant products that do certain things and have certain outcomes. And especially in the pharmaceutical world, they're going to want extremely pure, sterile products, and that's a whole other marketplace as well.
We're gonna pause here for just a minute, but before we do, Big Mike, where's the best way for people to get a hold of you and see your products?
Well, the best way would be Advanced Nutrients if you want fertilizer products to grow cannabis. The other one would be Big Mike's Blends, and also my Instagram, at Big Mike.
Okay, we'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
This is Dan Perkins, host of America's Cannabis Conversation, and I want to hear from you. Send me an email. Tell me what you like about our show, what you don't like about our show, what kind of guests you'd like to hear from, and are there subjects that are important to you that we're not discussing? Let us know. Go to W420RadioNetwork.com and send us an email. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us now is our newest guest, Emily Flippin, who is with The Motley Fool, and she works in the area of finding cannabis stocks for people, and they make recommendations of what to buy. And I've asked Emily to talk a little bit about herself, what she does, and the discipline that she uses to go in and define and identify particular stocks. And then she's going to tell us not so much about names, but sectors that she's kind of interested in for a very long-term investor. So, Emily, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. And I really appreciate the emphasis you put on there about long-term investors, because here at The Motley Fool, you know, we don't do a lot of stock turnover. We don't do a lot of buying and selling. We tend to be buyers of companies, good companies, and holding them for at least 5 years. And that's the same approach that we take to investing in the cannabis industry.
In your last appearance, you said you'd been with Motley Fool about 2 years. What did you do before you joined them?
Yeah, I actually worked with GE on their energy financial services team, analyzing debt projects. So it's a little bit of a change to me in terms of what I'm doing with my career, but I've been a personal investor for as long as I can remember. So it's been an exciting change at that.
Good. So let's talk about what is your day like? What do you do?
Well, the cannabis industry definitely keeps me busy. It seems like every day there is some new and exciting news, or less than exciting news. But for the most part, what I'm doing is I'm just evaluating the companies that we have on our scorecard currently and looking for new opportunities. And there's a lot of those in the cannabis industry.
And so can you give us a sense of what your analytical process is like?
I tend to think that when you're investing in cannabis, need to develop a relatively formulaic process. And that's not to say that it's one built around models, because modeling financials for cannabis companies is an exercise in false precision. It is to say that you need to have a very clear idea about why you're investing in a company, what your thesis is, and what would make you change your mind. Because when you see 10, 20, 30% pullbacks in the companies that you're invested in, you need to go back to your original thinking and ask yourself, what's changed? Has it changed my thoughts on the company, or is it just noise? The vast majority of the time in the cannabis industry, it's just noise. So how I go about that personally is I developed, it's a 14-point checklist that I really evaluate all of my companies on. Not every company gets every point right on the checklist, but it gives me a foundation for looking at what I think is the most important aspects of cannabis companies. And that gives a good baseline, because you can come back to it 6 months, a year later, and think, wow, have any of these checkpoints changed? Have they, you know, improved? Have they digressed in any of these really important areas? And that builds the foundation of an investing thesis.
So give us an example of two or three things that are very important to you in looking at a cannabis stock.
I don't think there's any one thing that would be a deal breaker, but there are a couple of things that I consider really bright red flags. Now, the first one's management, and it's easy to say management, because that's a fluffy term, isn't it? What defines good management? But in my opinion, in the cannabis industry, if you have any reason to doubt management, the people making decisions in your companies, you should not be investing. And that could be as simple as, you know, speaking with management, or if you don't have the opportunity to do that, watching an interview with management. If you get bad feelings from them, which happens a lot for people in the space, look, don't invest, because you should think about investing in cannabis industries as giving those people your money. If you wouldn't give them your money, don't do it. But one of the other kind of harder metrics I look for is actually, so revenue growth, for instance. It's really important in every industry. But what I look for is revenue growth that's outpaced shareholder dilution. Now, that might sound like it's something really easy for companies to achieve, but you'd be shocked at the rate of shareholder dilution in most of the large Canadian companies, which is why I'm not personally invested in most of the large Canadian cannabis companies. If they're not growing revenue faster than they're diluting existing shareholders, I'm not interested.
So let's just take a pause there and define for our audience shareholder dilution. What are they doing? Are they issuing stock to buy more and more companies? What causes that red flag for you?
Yeah, you would think they're issuing stock to buy more companies, but the vast majority of the time they're issuing stock or other convertible notes that could be potential shareholder dilution for the sake of just keeping themselves afloat. Now, we know that the cannabis industry, especially the second half of 2019, was going to be extremely challenging. But it's important for companies to maintain financial discipline. If a company is not capable of managing their expenses and is burning rate burning cash at a rate that is so significant as to outpace their revenue growth, that's a serious problem.
Emily, one of the things that I am amazed at and creates some agita for me in looking at the cannabis industry and the cannabis stocks is that the traditional way a company operates does not apply to the cannabis industry for one very serious but important reason. It is an all cash business. And so that we don't have a widespread ability for any size of company in the cannabis business to establish meaningful banking relationships. So they're locked out of a lot of different situations because they can't create even a checking account. I mean, to pay your taxes, corporate taxes, in cash is something, paying your employees in cash. And at the same time, these are cash generators, which is putting enormous amounts of cash in the companies, but they can't do anything with it either, or they have to buy another company or buy more inventory or whatever. But this is a very unusual piece of an industry that I've never seen before.
It's an extremely challenging piece of the industry, too. When I speak to experts in the space, they can say one of two things is their biggest problem operating in the industry. I'd probably say the first thing is the stigma, which is understandable for anybody operating in the cannabis industry. But the second thing, yeah, is the regulations and the lack of financial access that these companies have. That being said, anytime there is a big concern, such as, you know, it's a cash-based business, they lack a lot of access, unless they're using a local bank, to banking institutions, that's opportunity for investors. And there's a lot of really interesting companies, big companies, companies that aren't cannabis businesses, that you wouldn't think about being cannabis businesses, that are actually benefiting from this trend. A few off the top of my head, you know, Shopify and Square, they got into the space pretty early on in managing payments for CBD-based companies. And then Brink Security, actually, so the people who manage the armored cars, yeah, they're doing that for Canopy Growth. And so they're actually transporting the cash. So it's a big concern. It's one that I think will change over time. But over the short term, there's some interesting plays that investors looking to get exposure to bigger, safer companies while still getting the upside of the cannabis industry can get as a result of these cash-based transactions.
I did an interview with a gentleman who his company owns 10 dispensaries, vertically integrated program in California. And in August, in one city, he has 10 dispensaries. Three of them were robbed. And he lost over $685,000 in cash that was stolen, plus probably an equal amount of product. In fact, one of his dispensaries, the robbers stole a car and crashed it through the front door. And they actually pulled the safe out of the floor to take it with them because they knew there would be money and product in there. So the Justice Department says that over the last 12 months, about one in five dispensaries, pretty close to one in five dispensaries, were robbed. And the average cash was about $273,000. And I believe with the industry growing at 35% a year, the problem is going to get even worse because there's going to be more and more cash coming into the dispensaries. And yet the House passed the safe banking bill, but it seems to have gone nowhere. The risk profile, I believe, is rising for the owners, the employees, and maybe even the customers going into dispensaries because of the huge cash inflows.
Yeah, it's actually a good point that you mentioned the customers in that transaction as well, because, you know, early projections, especially in states like California, show that upwards of 75% of the legal cannabis market, or the cannabis market, is illegal. So it's going to the black market. And in addition to things like taxes and regulations, you have to think that the safety element does start to play into consumers' minds. If someone doesn't feel safe visiting a dispensary, if someone doesn't feel safe working at a dispensary, and more important, if someone doesn't feel safe or protected by owning a dispensary, they don't feel like they're going to make money on that investment. That's a really big problem for the legal cannabis industry.
What I don't understand, Emily, we've only got about a minute or so left. What I don't understand is that California is a mess at the moment. They want to do audits on the licenses. They suspended 460 licenses in Los Angeles. The people who bought licenses, not sure whether they actually own them. They can't expand their buildings or they can't finish out a building. So there's no revenue and a lot of cost. But what I don't understand is that the states are putting so much emphasis on the legal cannabis market, but don't seem to be doing much about the illegal market. And in California, you can walk into a store that's legal and walk next door to a store that's illegal and buy cannabis on an illegal basis. Why are we not seeing any movement on the illegal side of the business?
Yeah, California is always an interesting state because they tend to be overzealous in terms of regulations and taxes. And I think in a lot of minds of officials, of government officials and politicians, is once you legalize cannabis, that fixes the black market problem. You don't make it illegal anymore, there's no black market. And that's simply, as you mentioned, not how it works. We're seeing it in Canada where cannabis has been legal for over a year now, and the majority of cannabis consumption is still happening on the black market simply because the government is making regulations and making policies that are really challenging for legal cannabis businesses. I would expect that as Canada and the U.S. gets their footing in terms of analyzing the cannabis industry and politicians begin to become aware of the actual effects of these policies, I would expect that to change. But anytime you're working with the government, you know it's going to be a slow process. So I wouldn't expect for any investor to think that this, or any consumer to think that this is going to change over the short term. These are long-term predictions.
So unfortunately, Emily, we're out of time. A fascinating discussion. I did want to bring attention to our audience to make sure that they listen to the show on the 21st, I think it is, of this month, when Emily's going to be talking about a reopening of a service that they have had in the past that could be very interesting to investors. What is that service going to be?
Yeah, we're planning on reopening the service that I work on, which is Marijuana Masters. I act as an advisor for that service. It's a cannabis-based stock picking service. So you kind of mentioned the way that I go about thinking about investing in cannabis companies, and that service really is focused on three baskets of cannabis companies. One of those is PurePlays, the companies that people might associate with the cannabis industry, you know, the producers and retailers. But we also look at companies that I call picks and shovels, so companies that are doing business with other cannabis companies, and even ancillary companies, so companies that are, you know, have really strong underlying businesses that get exposure to the cannabis industry as a smaller part of their business. So there's lots of really interesting ways that consumers can get involved, and I'm really excited to be reopening that service in December.
Tell our people how they can get a hold of you and follow you and tweet with you.
People can always find me on Twitter. As I mentioned before, I'm always really excited to talk about cannabis companies. It's what I spend all of my time thinking about, so I love to talk with anybody about that on Twitter. But you can always visit our website at fool.com.
Emily, thank you for a wonderful interview, and we'll look forward to talking to you on the 21st.
Yes, yeah, thank you again for having me. I really appreciated it.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Dan Perkins, and we're about halfway through today's conversation. I hope you have found the people interesting and helpful. In case you didn't hear all of the interviews in today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com to listen to this show. If you missed any of our previous shows, or you want to hear a particular show again, you can go to the archives and download a missed show anytime that's convenient for you. Our goal is to bring a high-quality program that is both entertaining and informative. For those of you who are in the industry, we hope we can continue to be your voice, telling the people of America the benefits of this amazing all-natural product. We have been surprised at the willingness of important people to come into this new program and talk about the challenges and opportunities in the cannabis industry. It's hard to believe that it's been 23 years since cannabis was made legal in California. I think the next 23 years might be even more exciting than the first 23. One more thing before we get back to the conversation. Should you have a question or a comment, please contact us at contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. That's contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. And now, back to the conversation.
So welcome back to the conversation. And who we have today in the conversation is one of our favorites, our cannabis doctor on call, Jordan Tischler. And he's going to talk to us today about a very important kind of mental health issue in the country today, one of our topics. Jordan, thank you for joining us today in the conversation.
My pleasure, as always, to be here. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. So we're going to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. And I know that you work in this area. We talked about it. You and I have talked about it before. Right now, probably when you mention PTSD, we think of veterans. But there are other incidences where other people who are not military have PTSD. So as we've done in the past, let's talk about what it is and who's likely to have it, and then how can cannabis possibly help. So, Doctor, you got the floor.
Well, you know, the reality here is that PTSD is what we call a syndrome. It's a collection of symptoms that can have a series of causes. And those causes, you know, were first recognized in the military setting, or really most likely in the post-military setting. But what we've come to understand is that this is really a fundamental brain issue, and therefore any sort of severe trauma can cause this sort of thing. And so, you know, the horrors of war are kind of an obvious example. And the veterans are often very afflicted with this sort of thing. But we see this now, whereas we're understanding it more across all segments of our society. And so we have, children who are abused grow up and can have PTSD, women who are assaulted or others who are assaulted. There are a wide range of traumatic experiences that lead to a similar set of ongoing reactions or negative reactions that are very harmful to people's lives. And that's really what PTSD is.
Is it primarily a function of some physical impact or reaction as opposed to that causes PTSD? And is it possible to get PTSD from non-violent contact?
I think the answer is yes, it can be from nonviolent trauma, but most trauma that we by percentages would be violence, not necessarily physical on the victim who has the PTSD, but also witnessing or otherwise being party to it. I think it's also worth remembering that the Congresswoman's comment was about what's triggering her pre-existing PTSD. It's not that she's claiming that the impeachment stuff is so traumatizing that it's giving her or creating in her PTSD, but rather that as a child growing up in a war zone, she developed PTSD, and there are elements of the social circumstance in which she finds herself now that are triggering those PTSD responses. And that's actually something that we see commonly with PTSD victims, whether military or otherwise, that the triggers, the things that have come along in sort of daily life when the danger of that trauma has long gone away, can be very subtle and very unpredictable, but the response to those triggers can be very brisk and debilitating.
Let's don't assume that all of our listeners understand what PTSD looks like. Let's describe it a little bit. Let you tell me and our audience how does one know if they have post-traumatic stress disorder? What are the symptoms?
Well, the shortest answer to that is if you're feeling lousy emotionally, then you probably should find yourself a psychiatrist or a psychologist to delve more deeply into this. But the general constellation of PTSD are things like hypervigilance, right? The feeling of always being on edge and being wary about danger, even in situations that don't ordinarily provoke those symptoms for other people or in which there is no evident danger. That's often accompanied with depression and anxiety, and in many cases, very significant and disruptive nightmares and other sorts of things that lead to a sleep disorder, which of course compounds things because we don't function very well, both cognitively and emotionally, when sleep is deprived. So those are kind of the global constellation of symptoms.
So what are the treatment options, doctor?
There are a number of treatment approaches. Certainly you've described one there that seems perhaps, I think, to our listeners to be fairly extreme, which, you know, falls kind of into the category of desensitization. There are a number of other cognitive or psychotherapeutic approaches. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to be effective. And then we kind of start to look at some of the pharmacologic approaches, meaning medications. And the success rate is iffy, right? In other words, it helps some people and it helps some people somewhat, but not necessarily 100%. And then there are some people for whom these things don't really work at all. And those things tend to range from antidepressants like the SSRIs, occasionally benzodiazepines or other anti-anxiety medications, though, as we know, those have some significant risk from long-term use. And then there are some other sort of more esoteric medications that may be helpful in particular situations. Excuse me, for example, when people are having particularly vivid or ghoulish nightmares, there are some medications that can be helpful. I think that overall, the short answer is that patients come with a range of symptoms and a range of sort of underlying psychology and biology, and that there's no recipe for success that works for everybody. And so, you know, careful ongoing treatment is important to figure out which combinations of approaches are going to best help any individual with PTSD.
There's one question I really have to ask you, and I get it all the time as I travel around the hospitals. Am I ever going to get rid of this? Is it ever going to go away, PTSD? Is there a cure?
You know, I don't In medicine, we never say never. So are there veterans who come back and they don't have PTSD? Sure. Are there veterans who come back and they have PTSD, but it gets better? Yes, absolutely. Do the people who get better not have it anymore, or is it sort of under control? That I don't think we know the answer to. I mean, I think that's very individual. And then there are some folks for whom this is an ongoing process that may be lifelong, and our goal really isn't necessarily to cure them and to make it go away, but rather to give them the tools, whether they're psychological and or pharmacological, to manage it, you know, and where there may be, in fact, irreparable damage done, but our goal hopefully is to help them live a comfortable and productive life.
So in the time we have left, Doctor, how does, in your practice, how does or does cannabis come in play in treating people with PTSD?
Cannabis can be extraordinarily useful in treating PTSD, but one has to also understand that it's not a magic bullet any more than any of the other methodologies that we've just talked about. So cannabis can be extraordinarily helpful for the acute onset of anxiety and that hypervigilant state. It can be useful for issues around insomnia, and it can be useful, again, for the depression that often goes along with PTSD. The key here is that the way in which it's used depends upon which features of all of those things are, you know, primary for that individual. And it's also important to understand that particularly in the areas of behavioral health, cannabis can backfire if you're not careful about it. And so, unfortunately, what we see in a number of studies that look particularly at veterans with PTSD is that they go from not using cannabis to way overusing cannabis in very short order in the situation where they have access to cannabis but don't have a proper regimen devised for them, and they don't have ongoing guidance from a clinician. When it backfires, it can really be harmful, not in the sense of it can kill you, because cannabis won't kill you, but if you have severe PTSD, things that can make the PTSD worse in some aspects are really a backfire. And so you can, in fact, develop sleep problems while using cannabis for sleep if you're not doing it right and carefully and sort of in a measured fashion. Similarly, as most people who've ever used cannabis and sort of momentarily overdone it can attest, you can provoke anxiety with cannabis. And it's very much dependent upon the dose and how that dose is delivered, as well as the cognitive and emotional milieu at the time that that dose is delivered. And so doing cannabis simply by itself is often a challenge, and using it in conjunction with some of these things like CBT that we talked about is a better approach. And really being thoughtful and careful about the dosing and the timing and the delivery, that can lead to very positive outcomes, whereas kind of the whatever dude approach can actually be very, very harmful.
Right. Well, Doctor, unfortunately, we're out of time. I thank you for helping us learn more about PTSD and how cannabis. And so, Dr. Jordan Tischler, how can people get a hold of you?
If people are looking to get in touch with me, go to my website, which is inhalemd.com. Again, inhalemd.com. And there are a whole bunch of resources there that you can read, as well as ways that you can get in touch with me. And I should mention that we do telemedicine, so that even if you're not in my backyard, I'm certainly available to help.
Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Dan Perkins here with the American Cannabis Conversation. Breaking news. More than 100 billion, that's right, billion pain pills saturated the nation over 9 years. Newly disclosed federal drug data shows that more than 100 billion doses of oxycodone and hydrocodone were shipped nationwide from 2006 to 2014. 24 billion more doses of the highly addictive pain reliever than previously reported. The data, which traces the path of every pain pill shipped in the United States, shows the extent to which opioid flooded this country as deaths from the epidemic continued to climb over 9 years. The volume of pain pills distributed skyrocketed as the epidemic claimed more lives. From 2006 through 2014, more than 130,000 Americans died from prescription opioids overdose. I do want to point out that no person has died of an overdose of cannabis in the United States. This is Dan Perkins.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
Welcome to the conversation. We're joined today by Brent Schnapp, who is, let's just call him a founder. He's been in the cannabis business one way or another for, we figured out, about 30 to 35 years. And we're going to talk to him today about his experience, what he's happening in the industry, and where he thinks it's going. So, Brent, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Tell the audience how you first got involved with cannabis and why.
Well, I mean, the better part of that 30 years was effectively, I would say, as a user of various levels of intent. I did my first extraction at a personal level to make butter way back in college and made brownies and toast points with it. So I had a little fun with it, but I've always liked to have fun with cannabis and think of it as a good thing rather than as a dangerous or naughty thing. So
when did it, you become more serious about it?
Yes. So thank you. So around 2013-14, I started working with a local here in Seattle, a local medical grower. I had a license and ended up delivering for him as I-502, the Iowa record or the Washington State recreational law was being passed. He wanted to get a processing and growing license, what was called a producer license. I helped him with those endeavors, business planning, stuff like that. Even during the security check, we had to fight off a goat with a folding chair because he was in the foothills of the Cascades. It was quite a scene. This gentleman, I'll keep his name out for the sake of privacy. There's a bit of brotherhood that comes with it, and he was taking a very business-like approach to things, and, you know, given my background at Microsoft, I automatically do that, and so that's what brought us together in that particular endeavor. And then, you know, frankly, I never wanted to do cannabis for a living. I always wanted to enjoy it because I came from the video game industry, and I found that doing video games for a living made playing them a little less fun for me, and so I didn't necessarily want to have cannabis be a for-profit thing in my life. But, you know, just one thing leads to another. And so after doing the medical thing, I actually did some business consulting on the side. So it hasn't been a continuous run. More formally, I got into it with a place on the Olympic Peninsula in 2016, selling and representing a company called Dream City. They were subsequently bought by another company, a larger, you know, as part of the aggregation happens. But that's where I was actually selling flower cartridges from growers and producers into the retail market here within Seattle. So that was really my, you know, roll up the sleeves, do traditional business aspect in the recreational world. After that, I ended up working for a vacuum company that while their technology applied to the cannabis world, my technology side came in and I worked with them for about a year. And then for about 2 years, I worked with a commercial drying company that sold commercial dryers into the hemp world. And so then I went from a recreational environment into an industrial hemp and agricultural environment. And given my background from Iowa, I fit right into that as well. So kind of a potpourri, a mixed bag background of formal and informal participation, but fairly formal participation for the last 5 to 7 years.
Let me step back for a second, because as we talked in the pre-show interview, I said one of the many things we do in this program is to try and to help people understand who are not in business what it means to be in the business and one of the things that has to be done. And you said something a moment ago that we've never talked about, and you might be the perfect person to talk about it.
you mentioned at least three different licenses, and I'm fascinated by how much the regulatory environment has invaded this cannabis industry. Talk to me about some of the different kinds of licenses people have to have in order to get into the business, whether they're growing or distributing or manufacturing.
The licensing is going to fall into two tiers right off the bat. There's going to be three buckets: recreational, medical, and industrial hemp. So, and their restrictiveness typically will go like this. The most restrictive is medical, because you'll have to have a doctor's license to get your ability to buy it. Recreational, because it's limited by state and local jurisdiction, and you have to be 21 or older. The industrial hemp and CBD side is still yet to be determined, because the FDA hasn't yet passed down its rules and regulations, so its governance at a national level hasn't happened yet. So CBD rules and regulations are happening, much like the recreational side, more at a state-to-state level and through state legislatures and in governing agencies.
I understand that there are some states, and I think I've got this right, who require vertical integration, meaning you not only distribute it, you have to grow it and process it. And if that's the case, I think that's the case, for example, in Jersey, and I can't speak to the other ones. I know about Jersey because I've been in the Jersey market for some time. But there's got to be a whole bunch of licenses if you have to integrate to do everything from growing it to processing it to distributing it to selling it.
Yeah, in the real core to all these licenses is enforceability. And each state has a different type of enforcement mechanism to enforce its policies. You know, the state of Washington has the Washington State Liquor Control Board. The state of Iowa, for example, would use the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Different states, and so each governing jurisdiction is going to have a different set of rules and regulations. And typically those rules and regulations bend around the agency's ability to enforce. So getting back to your point with Jersey and vertical integration, that may be because Jersey isn't, I'm going to make this up, and my apologies to any Jersey agriculture people. You know, Jersey maybe is a smaller agriculture state, so they want their farmers to have everything in order before they do it. I can't speak to that particular thing, but if vertical integration was required, that seems, on my side, just to speak out of turn here a little heavy-handed on the state to force people on how to do business, rather than just giving the regulations on how to do business, or on the boundaries to stay within as they do business. That frankly seems a little heavy-handed, but on the other hand, it may be this New Jersey wanting to protect its farmers so that they know if they put seeds in the ground, there's a reasonable chance that there's going to be somebody to buy it at the end game.
In some states, you have multiple agencies overseeing the processes. If you want to do this, you have to apply to the Department of Agriculture. If you want to do that, you have to apply to the Alcohol and Tobacco Commission.
Here's why. I get more to the point of your question now. So some of the stuff simply ruled and regulated by the USDA. So if you're going to farm, you're going to probably be going through the U.S. the Department of Agriculture in most states. Then to do the processing, once the crop has been dried and you want to mill it, process it, and whether you turn it into smokable joints or extract it for CBD oil, that goes into a different rules and regulatory group. That goes into the FDA. So you shift from USDA for farming and the agriculture side to the FDA. And since the FDA hasn't done it nationally, each state agency will have its own equivalent of a health department. And it sounds like in Ohio, that's the pharmacy board. That's the group there. In the state of Iowa, it's the Department of Health. Here in Washington State, they treat it as an alcohol, so it's the Washington State Liquor Control Board. So each state will rule the CBD and the output side with a different governing agency, but most states will govern the farming side of it and up to the point of drying and through drying with the agriculture department in each state, generally speaking. So if that explains it, you're going to have to do different licenses because you're different. You're dealing with different governing agencies at different points in the process, and it's by state and by and it's different by state, and it gets complex.
We're talking to Brett Schnapp, getting into the cannabis business. Can you do this on your own, or do you definitely need a lawyer, and do you need a specialized lawyer?
I would definitely say you would want to have legal counsel in any business endeavor, as well as a good bookkeeper. Those were the two things that I always recommend to any client that I've worked with, is a good bookkeeper and good lawyer, and then a good assistant would be the third thing if you get overflowed yourself. But yes, the other aspect I would say is just start networking. Anybody that wants to get into this cold turkey, just start attending events and work your way up the knowledge food chain. Because you're going to come in, you know, your first week, everything's going to be brand new. By the second month, you're going to be on to much more advanced topics, you know, rather than asking, should I be doing business? You're modeling whether or not you can be profitable with the type of business you want to do. So you just need to dive in and get your feet wet and start gathering data. If you want to be in the business, you just have to jump into it.
As we were doing the research before we started to do this show, what we clearly heard is that the cannabis business may be the last major growth industry in the United States. And a lot of people, young and old, want to do something different with their life and want to get involved. And I'm wondering if you see the same thing.
Absolutely. Right now, the industry's ripe for cottage industries to be building up. But as time goes by, there's going to be aggregation. The smaller absorbs the larger. My background in the video game industry, real quick, you know, there used to be individual sound studios and small shops. Well, as time goes by, they get picked up and they aggregate their strength in numbers. And that's the normal ecosystem with any, you know, emerging and growing business. So, but we're at the very beginning right now. And I think the cycle that we're going to see and we're hitting right now, we had our first big growth spurt. There may be a year or two of overpopulation and people scratching their head. Then there will be likely, once the next set of rules and regulations, like the FDA, for example, take hold, there will be another rush. So there's going to be probably a double or triple bump out of this, and I think we're just getting through the first kind of bubble.
Thank you. We've been talking with Brent Schnapp, who is an experienced person in the cannabis business and has just been giving us a great lesson about some of the things you have to do, the different licenses. Brett, how do people get a hold of you, or how do they follow you?
BrettSchnapp@gmail.com. You know, if you want to just put my name up at gmail.com on your board there, I'd be more than willing to answer people's questions and help out. I'm just a big fan of the cannabis industry overall. It's been great for me personally, and I've seen it help others in their life and profession. And let's roll.
Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Dan Perkins, and thank you for joining the conversation. We hope you enjoyed the conversation today and invite you to join us next week. By the way, you can go to our website, www.americascannabisconversation.com. and download previous shows, but also on the website, you'll be able to see who our guests are going to be next week. So go to the website, americascannabisconversation.com, download shows, and look who's going to be on next week. This is Dan Perkins, and thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.
America's Cannabis Conversation.